Good morning, everyone. Meeting will come to order. Clerk will note the roll. There is a quorum.
Yeah.
We have the minutes of April 24th before us. Representative Carlson moves approval of the minutes. Any corrections, additions, changes to the minutes? Seeing none. All in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. All right, members, we'll get started on our agenda. Five bills today, starting with House File 678. The chair will move that House File 678 be referred to the General Register. Representative Quam, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means. Can you present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a fairly straightforward bill for memorializing with a license plate law enforcement. There's been a volunteer association, LUMA, which has provided assistance so that as soon as they hear of death of a law enforcement member, they contact the family, help out with assisting arrangements, are there for the kids, they're there for even arrange and sometimes help attend the counseling sessions because of the difficult time, and they make sure that a quality services is presented. You'll see their uniforms very prominent, and they give due respect. And they came forward because they want to be able to show respect to the people that serve us day in, day out, whether it's raining, pouring, snowing, ice, and in dangerous situations. And that's what this bill is for, is to allow for someone to show honor to the law enforcement members that have given their lives.
Discussion to House File 678. Any questions or discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of House File 678 being referred to the General Register, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 678 is referred to the General Register. Representative Quam, again, chair will move House File 2287. And Representative Quam, I know there's a delete all amendment or an amendment. The chair will move the A17-0377 amendment. I think we probably should just take that up right now. Representative Quam, can you describe the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And basically, the Senate and House members of the Claims Committee meet. There is, some testimony, questions, and review. And the amendment basically adds details. You'll see that there are certain awards and payments, and the larger ones tend to be because of medical situations. And then there, it's pretty self-explanatory what we have for claims being covered are within the amendment for the bill.
Any discussion to the A17-0377 amendment? See no discussion. All in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Okay, members, we have the claims bill as amended before us. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Quam, can you tell me, are these all the claims that were recommended by the Claims Committee, or are there some missing? And if so, why are they missing?
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. That is these are all the normal claims. There was one other claim that would be precedent setting, and there have been discussions about a more appropriate way to handle that. And I've had discussions with the chair of the Natural Resources Committee and the chair of Commerce to find an appropriate way of addressing it without setting a precedent that is possibly open-ended. The Claims Committee is set up to allow for justice that cannot be, gained through the courts or is not covered in statute. The because legislators from both chambers sit down and they have the power to, you know, try and make amends. But with that power of sort of being, you know, judge and jury, comes the responsibility of precedent setting, and we have to be adults in how we try to address justice. And there was a claim in regards to resort, because they invested and took on risk and debt just before DNR put restrictions on walleye fishing. And in the testimony, it became evident that the DNR had been monitoring and sort of knew that there was a possibility for decades, going in the previous century. They also said that they did meet with representatives of the business community and the community as a whole throughout this period, but did not appropriately give them, I guess, a heads up of a possibility. And we did have legislation in a previous session to try and address this, but it wasn't encompassing enough to cover this. You know, when you meet and you have an emergency and you do a quick piece of legislation, that sometimes it's not comprehensive enough to cover the situation. Through discussions after the Claims Committee meeting, it became evident that we needed to have a thorough analysis of the best way to address it without causing some open-ended precedents to the claims. And that is what is evident in the amendment that was just adopted to the claims bill. So in parallel, there's attention being given. And because, you know, we've got the Senate version and our version, hopefully we can come up with some sort of a process that doesn't cause unforeseen or extensive additional precedent setting through the claims process, but in a normal legislative process to address that concern. So the short answer is yes.
Representative Hilston, do you have a follow-up question? Representative Carlson.
Please, no.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm just curious if the author could tell us, most of these seem to be providing funds for people that have had a permanent disability as a result. There is one here where it says for payments to medical providers. And, you know, we have an appropriation separate from this for medical treatment of prisoners, and I'm just kind of curious what the difference is. That's one of the larger amounts on the list, 4,000-something, being it just says medical providers. I think each and every other one is for a permanent damage to hand or thumb or finger and what have you, and ankle, I think, was one. But they were all permanent disability payments, as I understand it. The question is, why didn't the prison budget for medical treatment cover these medical providers? What were different?
Representative Flom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. Part of corrections is when you serve your sentence, be released. If there was a incident or medical issue that presented itself during the term they were serving incarceration that required treatment after the release, that would fall under this portion of paying providers.
That explains it, then. It was after release. So thank you.
Representative Lubling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Pomeroy, I'm just wanting to understand a little more about how this process works. So When we're looking at these various things, is there some kind of fault determination that gets made before, you know, when these claims are brought? So in other words, you know, if somebody does something themselves that and gets hurt because they were, you know, themselves negligent, do they still get a payment, or does it require some finding that it wasn't their fault? That's my first question. And then I'm really just curious about how the amount is determined. And the reason I'm really curious about that is that the these payments seem rather low to me for somebody who has permanent injuries, you know, assuming that this is fault-based. So they get hurt because somebody else was negligent because there weren't proper, I don't know, equipment or working conditions or something. So they get a permanent injury here in one case. Permanent injuries to left ankle, $3,000. Seems pretty low for permanent injury. And the rest of them, too. I mean, I think in the outside the prison walls, if somebody injured you permanently in some of these ways, I think you'd probably get a lot more. So I'm just curious about how this process works.
Representative Palm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a long-standing process that's evolved, and you know, there's precedence for it. And in order to help illuminate that, I do have a former friend next to me, and he could give you a more legally succinct definition.
Hello, sir. Could you state your name for the record and give us your testimony?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jason Keenly. I am a senior assistant reviser with the reviser's office and also counsel for the joint subcommittee on claims. Representative Liebling, to your question, the longstanding tradition that Representative Kwan mentioned is that we do calculate these based on the workers' comp schedule. And there is not a, to your question of fault, it is a relatively no-fault system. We don't require, other than, you know, in places where there's contributory injury, where we're trying to calculate the injury down to what is, you know, if there was a prior injury, you know, that's part of the calculation as to what the payout would be. But it is based on the workers' compensation schedule, and it is relatively no fault.
Mm-hmm. Representative Liebling?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. That's good to know and understand. So these numbers do seem low, but I guess, maybe you could just comment on that. Is that just because our workers' comp system has low rates, and how does this compare to what might happen, you know, if it was say, in the legal system as it tort?
Mr. Chair, yes, like I said, it is based on rule. The formulas are all, well, a combination of statute and rule as to the base dollar amount and the percentage on that. I could, if you want, I have the numbers, the percentages that each of these is based on, and a little more detail of the injuries. If you have a specific question about an injury, we could go into more detail as to what the exact injury was in the case and what the workers' compensation percentage is that injury, that the appropriation here is based on.
Thank you.
And thank you, Mr. Keenly. And Representative Palm, I just want to follow up on, I guess it was Representative Hillstrom's original question. So the Claims Committee did not recommend paying the other claim that was brought forward relating to the DNR. Is that true? They did.
Mr. Chair, the majority of the Claims Committee did vote for compensation of $150,000.
Okay, but at this point, they're looking at now addressing that in a different legislative way?
Correct, Mr. Chair. As was illuminated by Representative Liebling's questioning, there's a long-standing precedent and structure to the vast majority of the claims that we handle. Last year, we had multi-million dollars for compensation of exonerated claims, mm-hmm. and that encompassed a look-back period. But we do strongly look at what's the purview of the Claims Committee, what precedents, and how to more correctly address a grievance. In past years, we've had, I have brought forth the a bill to try and bring another avenue to address an issue of a subcontractor not being paid, those type of issues. So it is not unusual to try and address an issue outside of this bill. And my understanding is that I would not be surprised if the Senate, and we had a conference committee, had a different approach.
Okay. Any other discussion or questions on House File 2287 as amended? Representative Hillstrom.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. As a follow-up to your question, so how did the Claims Committee go about letting you know they wanted to go a different path, or did the Claims Committee take no action and this is you who believes we should go a different path?
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hillstrom. The Claims Committee is made up of the Senate and the House. Next year, just like last year, I'll probably be holding the gavel for the House side. And just like any other bill that you have to amend in a committee like this, you need to look at what is the best course, the most likely course to get passage. And so the past House chair and probably next chair had discussions, and out of those discussions, including some discussions with the senior House member from your side of the aisle about how to best address it without precedent setting, this amendment allows for the standard long-standing precedent claims to move forward in this bill and give further due diligence to try and address the appropriate way of the other and not hold up these claims where some of these people through the process have spent many months, if not a couple of years going through the process to get their compensation.
Other discussion? Well, seeing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 2287 as amended be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 2287 as amended is referred to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Kwan.
Thank you.
Well, the next we'll take up House File 179. Chair will move that House File 179 be referred to the General Register. Representative Scott, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you for having me, Mr. Chair.
Do you want to have the amendment now at this time, or do you want to talk about the bill first and present the bill?
Mr. Chair, if I might, I'm not sure how many people have heard the bill before, so I'll just give a brief overview of the bill, and then the amendment may make more sense.
All right, please do.
Thank you. So, House File 179 prevents the Department of Public Safety from tracking the whereabouts of persons on the Ignition Interlock Program unless it's court-ordered. Currently, many of the Ignition Interlock devices are now equipped with some sort of location tracking component to them, whether that be GPS or a cell phone triangulation sort of component. And such devices were installed on these program participants without their knowledge. And this was brought to light, I believe, late last summer, early fall. And so this bill does correct that situation. It requires that any vendors doing business in the state of Minnesota, any Ignition Interlock vendors, that is, must notify the people that are on the program that their device contains location tracking capabilities. And one of the other things that this bill does is it reinstates the rulemaking process in relation to the Ignition Interlock program. When it was passed in 2010, there was a real hurry to get the program implemented, so there was an exemption from the rulemaking process. And that exemption is one of the reasons we're here today, is because it seems like there wasn't enough light shed on that. So the department was allowing these devices to have GPS and other tracking capabilities without the public knowing. And the reason I want to back up here and say that the reason that the department wanted this wireless connection was so that they could have real-time reporting. And their definition of real-time reporting, and they're here in the audience if there are any questions. What they do with the real-time reporting, they had some studies that they are saying claimed that if people know right away when they are in violation, when they blow a bad blow, that the rate of recidivism goes down. And so the process that the department has is they receive notification from the vendor that someone has blown a bad blow, and then my understanding is within a matter of a few days, and a letter is sent out to the person that has violated the terms of the Ignition Interlock program. We also learned during the course of the process on this bill that many of the vendors do have the capability to turn on and off the location tracking capabilities, and even when it's off, most of them can still provide the real-time reporting that the department is after. So that's why we're here today, Mr. Chair, and I could go ahead and have someone move that amendment. That's all right.
Okay. Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm happy to move the amendment. Representative Scott and I have worked together to try to address any issues with the bill.
Okay. Representative Hillstrom moves the A50 amendment. And can you briefly describe what the amendment does, Representative Hillstrom?
I can do that.
Or Representative Scott.
Thank you. So, Mr. Chair, on lines 1.2 of the amendment is just kind of some belt and suspenders language. And it just lines it up with another area of the bill as far as the court order issue. There are some judicial districts right now that are court ordering that the tracking capabilities be turned on, and so this just places that language in more than one place. And then if I could skip down to lines 1.5 and 1.6, that is... the original language of the bill states that that the department would have to bring any new rules before the legislature and have them approve it, and this just deletes that portion. And I think in my many talks with the department, I think they've heard the message loud and clear that we don't want any people to be tracked without their knowledge or without a court order. And, in fact, the department has said that they don't want that capability, they don't want the data that goes along with that. They just want to be able to tell these people a few days after they violated that they have violated. So, and then, Mr. Chair, I would like to delete lines 1.3 and 1.4 of the amendment.
Mr. Chair, I would incorporate that into my motion.
Okay. Representative Hillstrom incorporates the deletion of lines 3 and 4 on page 1 of the A50 amendment. Those to be deleted. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a general question, I guess, to the author. Maybe we can finish up the amendment. If you're under that first, and I'll come back to this.
Okay. All right. Other discussion of the A50 amendment as amended. So no discussion. All in favor of the A50 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The A50 amendment as amended is adopted. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Scott. I'm curious. I actually have an employee who is currently using the interlock system and doing a fantastic job with his sobriety and everything. And when I asked him about this, too, he had no idea that he could be or maybe even is being tracked. So I think this is a wonderful bill. My question would be is there a heavy cost or what is the plan to, I don't know, how many interlock systems are generally out there at one given time? And how many folks do we have to kind of reel back in to make sure their system is actually complying now with the law? Is that going to be quite a burden to the state or to the current participants of the program? And how will they, and if they need to be compensated for that extra step or coming back to the vendor? Again, in our case, we have to kind of drive, I guess, to Hutchinson or out of town for a vendor near us. So just can you address that, please?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Baker, I would ask the department those questions. They're more privy to the number of people on the interlock system. I want to say it's around 9,000 people, but I'm not really sure. I've asked the department just to weigh in on that, and then what they are doing going forward to notify people about this situation.
Okay, thank you for coming forward. If you could state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Hi, I'm Jill Freudenwald. I'm the Ignition Airlock Program Administrator at the Department of Public Safety. So currently we have 10,000 active participants. We continuously graduate people, so we graduated over about 12,000, but right now we have 10,000 active. There's 5 ignition interlock companies currently certified in the state of Minnesota. 2 of those companies have shut off the GPS already, the location tracking, so I don't anticipate, you would have to ask the companies directly, but I don't think there would be any additional burden or cost for them. One of the companies, as far as the department understands, may have to do some programming in order to separate the GPS from the real time. They are aware that that might be a requirement due to what's been going on in the legislature, so I think they may be working on that. Another one of the companies has been working on that, and I believe it may be already completed, the turning off of the GPS, and they may have already implemented that. I just don't have confirmation. And they're at the third company, which is smaller, so I sometimes don't always remember, but they have turned that off. So 3 of the companies have already separated that.
Any other questions for Ms. Redenwald? All right. Thank you very much, Representative Scott.
Mr. Chair, I do have one oral amendment that I'd like to make, too. It's on line 1.14 of the bill.
Line 1.14. All right.
And I would like to delete the words in whole or in part. I spoke with the department this morning, and they are think that that is rather vague language. And so I think we've got other areas of the bill that tighten up the language enough to make it clear what we're trying to do here. So if someone would.
Okay. Representative Duskowski.
Mr. Chair, I would move that oral amendment to delete on 1.14 the words in whole or in part, comma.
Okay. Representative Duskowski moves page 1, line 14, delete the words in whole or in part, comma.
Mr. Chair, I think actually both commas would have to be deleted. And Mr. Sullivan's nodding his head.
All right. Both commas. Delete comma in whole or in part, comma. Discussion to the Duskowski amendment. See no discussion. All in favor of the Duskowski oral amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. The Duskowski oral amendment is adopted. Discussion to the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank Representative Scott for working so hard on getting folks to agree on these provisions.
Okay. Representative Scott, any last comments on the bill?
I'd appreciate your support.
All right. Members, see no further discussion. The chair will renew his motion that House Bill 179, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. House Bill 179, as amended, is referred to the General Register.
Thank you.
Next, we have House File 2080. Representative Nornes moves that House File 2080 be referred to the General Register. And Representative Nornes, I see you have the A1 amendment. Do you want to have that amendment? Is that your amendment?
I need to find it.
It is. All right. I think it's mostly a technical amendment.
I would agree with that, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Nornes moves the A1 amendment, and I guess, Mr. Marks, maybe you brought this to our attention. Can you discuss the amendment?
Mr. Chair, this is simply to make sure this appropriation doesn't occur more than once. It is similar to language in the Higher Education Omnibus.
Okay. Any discussion of the A1 amendment? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just kind of curious about that. Does that mean that we have to watch for this all the time? Because it's pretty common for things to be in more than one place.
Mr. Marks?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, It's not real common necessarily, but we do watch for that to make sure that we don't count things more than once that have that potential anyway.
I think particularly when there's money involved as opposed to policy.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you. I'm glad Mr. Marx is on the job.
So am I. Other discussion of the A1 amendment. All in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The A1 amendment is adopted. Okay. Representative Norris, can you present your bill, short as it is?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, House File 2080 simply appropriates $50,000 in fiscal 2018 and 2019 to the Office of Higher Education for a grant repayment assistance program. And the grant must be used to provide debt relief to attorneys with full-time employment providing legal assistance or representation to low-income clients or support services of similar work. So it's all about reducing the educational debt burden. In this case, it's lawyers, which we don't often talk about very much. The money is from the general fund.
Discussion to House File 2080 as amended. No discussion. Representative Norris renews his motion that House File 2080 as amended be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 2080 as amended is referred to the General Register. The last bill on the agenda is House File 1265, Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Heintzman, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means. The Chair will move that House File 1265 be referred to the General Register.
Yeah.
And Representative Heintzman, do you want to present House File 1265 or do you want to take up the amendments? Which would you like to do first?
We might as well go and move the amendments, Mr. Chair.
Okay. The Chair will move the A11 amendment. And Representative Heintzman, I'll let you describe that amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, we have a couple of projects that I would like to add back into the LCCMR bill. Over the course of the last few weeks, I've had some folks come to me and suggested that these items would be beneficial coming back, and so I am hoping to go ahead and do that now.
Okay, discussion to the A11 amendment.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Erdahl.
Do we have a little more description of what the A11 amendment does?
Representative Heintzman.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. Specifically, the Cedar Creek Natural Area Wolf Recolonization Assessment is a study. University of Minnesota has been working on some research, and we'd like to continue that. And then the Neoka State Park land acquisition. As some folks may know, in that area there's a bison herd, and this acquisition would help, apparently, to expand that area that's available. I'm told by a number of representatives in the area in that the bison like their space, so I'm trying to help them out.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to hear about bison.
All right. Representative Carlson.
Now, Mr. Chairman, were these all included in the recommendations by LCCMR's board?
Mr. Chair, members, Michael McDonough, LCCMR staff. Representative Carlson, yes, the recolonization was a recommendation of the commission, so that's being put back in its entirety. The state park acquisition project, there were four projects. This puts in back one. It was a $1.5 million recommendation, so this would restore $5 million of that specifically for Minneapolis State Park, 135 acres.
Thank you. Other discussion to the A11 amendment? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I appreciated the question about being more specific about what was being put back in, but it seems to me there are a couple of other projects, too, just to be more complete in answering Representative Erdahl's question. On page 2 of the amendment.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, so these are continuations of projects that were not finished in the time that was allotted in the previous bill. And these all need, I think, to continue forward, and this amendment does that. So thank you for the question.
Representative Liebling? Okay. Any other discussion of the A11 amendment? Seeing no discussion, all in favor of the A11 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The A11 amendment is adopted. Now we have the A12 amendment. The chair will move the A12 amendment. And members, this language is identical to an amendment that we had. I believe it was to the environment bill that we took up that basically says that a county can adopt a board resolution if they are located in whole or in part north of U.S. Highway 2 to have no further purchases by the Department of Natural Resources of state lands unless they sell off a parcel of equal size, and there's language in terms of how they can do that. So I think that probably everyone's seen this amendment before. Representative Heintzman, any other comments on the amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You took the words out of my mouth, so thank you for that. I appreciate your explanation, and no, I didn't.
Okay, Representative Wagenius.
A couple of questions on this one. Mr. Chair, I don't know whether to ask you or ask the author or Representative Heintzman, but I'm looking at the projects that may be affected by this amendment, and it strikes me there are four, but since we don't have a map in front of us, so would the Mesabi Trail be affected by this?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. McDonough.
There are, the Mesabi Trail does not include acquisition or its easement, so that would not be affected by this. There are only two projects in here, and they're both local projects, so it would not be affected because they're state. Minneopa State Park was just added back in the previous amendment, but that's south of Highway 2. So there are no acquisitions in the first engrossment of 1265 that have acquisition that would be affected by this.
Representative Wagenius.
So the money for Crane Lake would not be included in this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, it would not because it's local. The amendment is for state land.
Okay.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you. Thank you for clarifying that. I appreciate that. However, there is another issue that's been, we're seeing a lot of press now in the sportsmen's, from the sportsmen's community about this particular provision as it is. So now I'm wondering why it is even in this bill, but we're seeing a lot of press about this. Could we have DNR tell us about what they think the impact is going to be?
Well, I do have someone who wants to testify on this from the LCCMR, Representative Wagenius, and so perhaps I can have them testify, and then if you have further questions, we can bring someone else down from the DNR. Representative Wagenius.
Well, it's on the amendment that I was asking LCCMR about, not on the general bill.
Oh, okay. I thought the person from the LCCMR wanted to testify on the amendment, but I guess maybe it is on the bill. So, sure. Do we have a representative of the DNR here that would like to come forward? That's Mr. Meyer, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for the record. Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources, and thank you for the opportunity to testify on this amendment. And there is a large groundswell occurring out in greater Minnesota and in Minnesota in general about the activities in the legislature from the sportsmen. It was interesting at the Lassard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council meeting on Friday, some members of the public addressed the committee at the end, and I encourage you all to listen to that testimony. The impact of this is really well beyond the LCCMR bill, and it really pits one group of stakeholders against the other. For example, if we were wanting to put a new water access site on the Rainy River north of Highway 2, now I would have to turn around and sell an equal amount of land, perhaps owned by the Division of Forestry or a wildlife management area. Even if the county wanted us to do that and had a no net gain provision, I would be unable to do that unless I sold some land. It also goes on to require the Commissioner of Administration for lands acquired by another state agency to sell land, which the Department of Administration doesn't really own land north of Highway 2. The land holdings are very limited. So really what we're presenting is a no acquisition prohibition on north of Highway 2 unless the department or another entity would sell some land. So, for example, the Voyagers or the Prospectors ATV Trail, that's very popular in northeastern Minnesota. If part of that were to require state acquisition, now you'd be pitting, again, the Division of Forestry or the Division of Fish and Wildlife to sell some land so the Division of Parks and Trails could perhaps have an easement or an acquisition of this trail to run through. Our concerns are that we work with these counties north of Minnesota, north of Highway 2 on a day-to-day basis. Our regional managers, our regional directors meet with these county boards on a monthly basis. In fact, Roseau County just recently approved an acquisition for the DNR just this month. So even though they have a no-net gain provision, these counties want these acquisitions to occur. St. Louis County, for example, has an acquisition of over 4,000 acres, I believe, occurring. It's a county acquisition. But they want to acquire more land so they can have a better portfolio of lands to manage and to provide recreation for. So the article you speak of, Representative Virginia, so there's an article in Brainerd Dispatch this weekend that talks about no net gain and how some of these people out in Minnesota are feeling right now. And we just feel this amendment is not necessary since we work with these counties daily talking about our land acquisition processes. And we always come to a point where if we can't come to an agreement, we don't do the acquisition. So I think what we're doing here is providing some problems without a solution.
Okay, Representative Dean, did you have a comment to this, to Mr. Meyer?
Yes.
Okay, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Meyer. From what I understand, the purpose for this is that in certain sections of the state, there's a disproportionate and almost entire, in some cases, ownership by some form of government, either state or federal. And that this is trying to get at a portion of that, meaning that if you acquire land, you have to get rid of some. But it doesn't really stipulate, as I read it in the legislation, that you have to do it immediately. It talks about how you can't essentially dump dump land for less than what it's worth, or 75% of what it's worth, as a bottom. Doesn't that seem reasonable, at least for some portions of the state that are really struggling with difficulties with a disproportionately high percentage of the land that's owned by some form or another of government, from a policy perspective, from the governor, from the agency? Do you think about that, and do you look at that as a whole?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dean, we do daily. We work with the counties north of Highway. We work with every county in the state of Minnesota on our land acquisition. We have a process called our strategic land asset management process, which we talked about at the Lessard Sam's Council on Friday as well. We sit down with the counties and talk about the plat books that they have and look at what lands they own and the lands the state owns and what our future conditions are supposed to be or what we desire to do, and work on exchanges and sales and long-term management goals. North of Highway 2 right now is not a priority for the Department of Natural Resources to acquire land just because we own, either in state, federal, or local holdings, a lot of land that's out there. Our concerns are what we call the prairie pothole region of the state, where there are a lot of threats and pressures on development and on water quality and habitat issues that are out there. So we understand that and we recognize that. To have a book where you have to sell land in the future to acquire land now is not what we want to do or desire to do that. We would rather work with the counties up front in an open fashion to do the acquisitions in a timely manner. The language also doesn't provide an exemption. Say a county has a no-net gain provision but they want to acquire land. It forces the department to sell land to acquire new land. It does not allow a county to opt out of this provision.
Well, Representative Meyer, let me just point out that if you look at lines 8 and 9, it says this applies when a county has filed a no-net gain of state lands policy under this section. And so, I mean, there aren't any counties that have
at this point adopted a no net gain policy underneath this section, because this, of course, is not law yet. So in terms of your concerns about some county up there that, you know, wanted you to buy a piece of property for something, I mean, those counties would all have to, in order for this to be effective, now adopt a specific policy relating to this in order for it to be effective. Representative Drazkowski, did you have a question for Mr. Meyer?
I did, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And Mr. Chair, I would just note, too, that counties, if they would actually start filing no net gain policies under the section, could also rescind them at any time, and that would be up to them to do. Mr. Meyer, back in 2012, the legislative auditor issued a report that was really a scathing report about the amount of land that the state government owns relative to the amount of resources and capability that it has to actually maintain and do the things it needs to do for and with those lands, including simple things like following the state's noxious weed law, which it has the inability to do right now, given the vast amount of land that the state owns and continues to accumulate at rates of 10,000 or more acres per year. So my question to you is, what's changed?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scott, that's a great question, and thank you for asking that. Over the past 8 years with the legacy amendment, we've been able to get our hands around the management of state lands. If you look at categories of land through the Outdoor Recreation Act, state forest lands are managed actively by loggers and by people who need the biomass for fuel and jobs out there. Our wildlife management areas, our scientific and natural areas, aquatic management areas, we've been getting millions and millions of dollars a year to do the maintenance and restoration and enhancement of these lands. Actually, I just asked staff today to pull some of those numbers together that I can present to you. But we are catching up at a dramatic pace. Where we do have a complaint from a county about a noxious weed problem, we're there taking care of it as soon as possible. Same day, if we know about it, if we get the good location with solid answers. So, you know, in the past, we have been struggling, but thanks to the dedication of the citizens of the state of Minnesota and passing the legacy amendment, we've been able to catch up dramatically, and I'll provide that information to the committee once it's pulled together.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Meyer. But, Mr. Meyer, the noxious weed law doesn't say you have to only control noxious weeds when you get a complaint. It says you have to control them. And so I guess the rhetorical question would be, are you controlling all the noxious weeds on all the state land in the state? We know the answer to that is no. But my question to you is, have you fully fulfilled all of the points in the legislative audit from 2012 that the legislative auditor laid out in order to correct the situation?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Koski, I do not have a copy of that report in front of me, but I believe we've accomplished many of those concerns that they've had, and I'll provide the committee with more information on that as well.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It sounds like I know as well. Thank you.
Members, I've got Representative Carlson, Erdahl, Hausman, and Loon, who have also raised their hands. Do any of you have a specific question for Mr. Meyer? Or is it more general discussion to the amendment?
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's on the amendment, but not necessarily Mr. Meyer. But so I can wait until people are done with Mr. Meyer.
Representative Drazkowski, did you have another question for Mr. Meyer?
I do not.
Okay. All right. Mr. Meyer, Representative Loon? Oh, yours is for Mr. Meyer. Okay. And Representative Hausman, yours goes too. Okay, let me go to Representative Hausman then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to just, again, get a sense of what I heard you say is, if this amendment were to become law, counties, we take some flexibility away from counties, that even if they wanted to move a particular way, we take that away. Did I hear you correctly?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hausman. Yes, and my assumption is that there's approximately 18 counties right now that have no net gain policies. I would assume that those counties would file those petitions under this section of law as soon as it went into law. So that's my major assumption in my testimony, so we just to be clear on that. So if that were to occur, there is no exemption here, and many times we're often able to work with the county boards to come up with a resolution, or we just simply do not move forward with that acquisition at that time.
Representative Fabian, to that point.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Meyer, you mentioned the acquisition and what you're doing in Roosevelt County, and appreciate that. I will remind you that it has been a very long process, as you testified to, and committee the other day, in the Lasard Council meeting the other day. I talked to one of the Roosevelt County Commissioners last night, and while they are appreciative of what's happened, they're also quite frustrated with the timelines and the lengthy process that's involved in getting to the resolution that we have. But I just want to be clear that, as the chair has pointed out, this is a new section of law, and if you are working with the counties, and I know that you are, I acknowledge that, as well as you say you are, this really should have no impact, because if they don't cite this section in a new no net gain policy, this would not be in effect. Is that not correct?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fabian, yes, and I have not spoken with any counties. I'm just under the assumption that they would register their no net gain policies under this section.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to continue, I know that the Northern Counties Land Utilization Board is voting a meeting on Thursday again this week, and I was told last night that they do intend to kind of renew their stance on no net gain. But I would also encourage you to continue discussions with those counties, pointing out some of the flexibility that actually is in this amendment that you're given, and have conversations with them. And as you said, in St. Louis County, with regards to the forestry, unless they adopt a no net gain provision under this section of law, it's not going to impact their ability to acquire those lands. And I think that it's important that people understand that. Members, this is a very frustrating situation in northern Minnesota. And again, I want to emphasize that they appreciate the conversations and so forth that they have had with DNR, because quite frankly, there have been a few good things that have happened recently. But I also think that it's important to continue having the discussion and to not only recognize but also respect the policy provisions of the Northern Counties and the County Commissioners. And these are all good people up there, Assistant Commissioner Meyer, and you know that. And with regards to some of the conversation that we had at the Lasard meeting on Friday, quite frankly, I was somewhat taken aback by the tone that some people used describing, you know, what the intent is of these different things. And I hope that we can get past some of the rhetoric and actually look at what the facts are here and continue moving forward for the good of, quite frankly, all Minnesotans. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Meyer, two quick points. The concern with Roosevelt County, we agree with the concern. The concerns about the strategic land asset management processes is the funding for the appraisals, the legal work, all of the work that needs to take place. That all costs money, lawyers, recording fees, and all of those. And we don't have that kind of money right now. And then Representative Fabian talked about the flexibility related to this amendment. I'd like to know what he's referring to as flexible in this statute. If a county adopts their no-net gain procedure under this section of law, it doesn't provide an exemption for us to work around that. So, I mean, that would be something we'd want to see in the language if it does move forward.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the flexibility comes in whether or not they actually adopt that provision under this section of law. And the conversations that you and I would encourage you to have with those northern counties. And if you can, I'll say, convince them not to adopt this, you continue to have all the flexibility that you have today.
Well, Mr. Meyer, I mean, if the county did adopt this, and then you came to them and said, gee, we'd like to buy this piece of property, and they thought, yeah, it would be a good thing for the DNR to buy this piece of property, it would seem the county could, as Representative Drazkowski hinted earlier, rescind this policy, at least for that particular piece of property, and then reenact it if they wanted to at a later time. Doesn't that make sense?
Mr. Chairman, I guess it does. It seems like a lot of hoops to jump through, but we could always work through that. And I think the bottom line is, and I'm hearing from certain people who want to sell their land to the state, is they're concerned about the legislature, about the state getting involved in what is a private party transaction. If a person wants to sell their land to the DNR, it's been their lifelong goal when they are on their deathbed or when they're moving to Florida or whatever, to sell their land to the state. this kind of flies in the face of that if the county would not want that to transpire. So I think, you know, at some point in time, we're getting close to these private property rights that are out there as well, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a kind of a data question, because I'm not steeped in all the knowledge in all of this. So, Mr. Mayor, do you know, could you tell me what percentage of the land that we're talking about above north of Highway 2 is currently owned by the state? Is there a percentage or acres or something that would give us context for what we're talking about?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rune, I don't have that map currently in front of me. I can provide that to you. The state owns a lot less land in northern Minnesota, north of Highway 2. Most of the land, especially as you get over to the northeast part of the state, is held by the federal government, either in the Superior National Forest, the Chippewa National Forest, or other lands that the state, that the federal government owns. But I do have a map that shows county by county the amount of state land that's owned and the amount of federal land. And I can provide that to the committee, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Mayor. Well, that's helpful. And I Representative Fabian shared with me that in Roseau County it's about 24%. So would that be approximately for the rest of those counties north of Highway 2 in total? And I think including the federal probably makes sense too.
Mr. Chairman, members, it probably is, but you have to peel back the layers of the onion and look at what kind of land that land is. Many of it's school trust land. It could be consolidated conservation land or tax forfeit land, which the counties manage, operate, and receive revenues off of. Out of the 5 million acres of land that the state owns, we've only purchased about 1.5 million. Those are considered acquired lands. A lot of the other lands, especially in northwestern Minnesota, are the CONCON lands, with consolidated conservation lands, which have been given to the state in payment to the state for paying off that tax levy that the counties incurred back when they tried to drain the water off of that property. So while there is a lot of public land out there, there's a lot of purposes and a lot of reasons why the state owns it, and you know, we're talking really about 1.5 million acres of acquired land. So it becomes rather complicated.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Meyer, when you said 24% of Roseau County is owned by the state, how much is owned by the federal government? I guess it was my understanding that north of Highway 2, there were several counties that 70 to 80% of the county was owned by either the federal or state government or some government entity. Is that true?
Mr. Chairman, yes, it is. And again, I think you need to paraphrase that with what has the state actually purchased versus what has remained on the tax rolls because nobody wants to buy it or it's been given back to the state. Coochie County, for example, is 80% wetlands. A lot of that is owned by the state. We haven't purchased hardly any of it. But without that payment in lieu of taxes associated with those lands that have been in state ownership many times forever, those counties would have severe operating problems.
Representative Fabian.
Nope, that was...
Oh, okay. All right, anyone have any other questions for Mr. Meyer? All right, thank you, Mr. Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, let me go back to Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm looking at the amendment here, and if I'm understanding lines 18 and 19, we're excluding the Department of Transportation, but we are including the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. And I'm just not sure what the impact of that would be when we're talking about the Minnesota system. Actually, that probably should read now Minnesota State. They've changed their name, but that's a technical question. But really what I'm asking is, and maybe Representative Erdahl, you know, most of the land that we have purchased in the area of higher education is sent through the capital investment bill. Sometimes we've tried to consolidate, and this kind of gets in the definition of land, the land within a campus, within a community. There are all kinds of issues when you start dealing with higher education. Now, I'll use the U of M as an example a few years ago.
Okay. Representative Carlson, if I can, let me cut you off because I appreciate you for mentioning that. It is supposed to be that including word in front of Minnesota State Colleges and Universities was supposed to be excluding.
Oh, okay.
So I guess I would incorporate that into the amendment to change on page 1, line 19, the word including, delete including and insert excluding.
Well, then, Mr. Chairman, I did read it correctly, but...
You did read it correctly. Okay. Thank you for bringing it.
That solves the question, although maybe at some point... I wasn't a big fan of their name change to Minnesota State. I thought that was confusing, but at any rate, I think in statute they're still Minsky. I think that was just by board action, so I'll withdraw my request to change that to Minnesota State, being that I don't like the name change.
Well, if you're going to do that, Representative Carlson, otherwise we've got a long amendment to the amendment of other changes in statute. I suspect we would have to find.
I think we'll leave that part of it alone. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Representative Erdahl.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. And with all due respect as the motives of this amendment, which I know reflect sincere beliefs, I do have several concerns. Some of them being brought up today. I'm concerned about the hoops that seem to make this sometimes a complicated procedure. I do have questions as to how flexible this is yet. I have a concern that Mr. Meyer mentioned as well that I've been expressing, and that is that we now have the government telling willing sellers who they can sell to. This has been stuck in 3-4 bills now. I believe there was an attempt to put it into the Health and Human Services bill under the no net weight gain provision.
I'm not aware of that one.
I thought it was in there.
It's the cheeseburger bill.
I would like to read from an email that one of my constituents sent me yesterday. If no net gain becomes law, it will be a disaster for our environmental causes. It will not be received very well by 75% of the people in Minnesota. This bill will not only degrade the ability of the legacy amendment funds to protect, restore, or enhance land, water, and wildlife, it will set a terrible precedent that constitutionally dedicated funding and voters' actions can be subverted and used for purposes for which it was never intended. In essence, I do believe that this amendment circumvents the constitutional amendment of 2008, 70% of the people in a recent poll registered support for the legacy amendment. And I just want to say that this Republican legislator continues to stand for the will of the people as expressed by their vote in 2008.
Representative Heisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Representative Dean's point, there are a number of legislators that are very sincere in their belief that they are representing their districts and their constituents. And I think the point was made earlier that this has been a conversation in the press over the last few weeks. And when I was contacted by media, I simply asked maybe that particular reporter would like to come with me for a few weeks and stand on doorsteps and hear about folks' frustrations. In some parts of the state, private property in and of itself is becoming an endangered species. In some places, as we heard earlier, over 80% of the county is in the hands of public, whether that be state or other agency or the federal government, and we're simply allowing a conversation to move forward so that people have an opportunity to share their concerns on this issue. And so while I appreciate the comments, Representative, I'm also not misrepresenting my district, or in some cases other representatives are certainly having some strong concern on this issue. So that is probably a classic example of, one part of the state, there may be a concern that might not be in other parts of the state.
Well, and Representative Erdahl, I guess I would just say, too, that, again, this only applies north of Highway 2. And, again, in terms of the representation of people and their opinions, this only applies if, in fact, a county board, which is elected by the people from the county, would choose to take this particular action. But I know this is a, an amendment that has certainly heartfelt feelings on both sides. Any other discussion to the amendment? Representative Dreskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just, mention to Representative Erdahl, I think I may have received the same email with a different name on it from an interest group out there. But, Mr. Chair, on the previous time we had this amendment before us, I offered and you incorporated on line 1.11 between the words equal and number, the words or greater. And that would provide a functional, more better functionality to it for the agency and all involved.
I recall that now, Representative Drazkowski. Thank you. All right. I would incorporate into the amendment on page 1, line 11, after the word equal, insert or greater. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, did you incorporate in your amendment as well the correction of the error?
I did.
Yeah.
Okay. Other discussion to the A-12 amendment? See no discussion. All in favor of the A-12 amendment with the incorporations that I mentioned, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The A-12 amendment, as amended, is adopted. Okay, I see no further amendments. We do have Nancy Gibson of the LCCMR wanted to come forward and testify. Mr. McDonough, thank you, at least for the moment. Ms. Gibson, please come forward. And Ms. Gibson, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you very much. My name is Nancy Gibson, and I am currently a vice chair of the LCCMR, and I appreciate this opportunity to come and talk to you and express some of my concerns. As you may know, LCCMR is a uniquely qualified fund where diverse natural resources needs can be addressed, where research projects are peer-reviewed and are enhanced by national experts. LCCMR was on the forefront with triclosan, invasive carp, white-nosed bat syndrome, and precision agriculture long before they hit the headlines. We take into account all the different categories, the geographical areas, their outcomes, and their job impact. House File 1265 deleted 140 jobs. 16 of those 25 deleted projects had a statewide impact. I know we have a long process, but it's a very worthy one. This last round, these deleted projects had high original scores from commission members. Ranking number one was Rearing Native Mussels. It ranked 15 out of the 16 members voting, followed closely by Native Prairies, SNA, State and Metro Parks, Solar Cell Manufacturing, the Raptor Center, and Climate Generation Education were close behind. Yet now, they're all deleted. I've been on the commission since 2006. I was appointed by Governor Pawlenty. And every year I question and even dislike some of the projects. But I like the process. I respect the commission, our staff, and I am sincere when I really think we do a great investment for our natural resources. And I don't want our resource stakeholders to refrain from applying for funds due to these uncertainties. I'm here to ask you to reinstate all of the deleted projects. The deleted projects were a way to find funding for CREP. I'm a supporter of CREP, and I would guess that most of the commission members feel the same, or they would not have approved the original LCCMR package that gave $6 million towards CREP. I'm trying to find a solution. As the six citizen expert members, we are very concerned about this. Could we know the CREP does not need the federal dollar match this year. We also know that the governor has it in his bonding package. But could we examine whether CREP can adequately begin their work with the $6 million they're going to receive on July 1st? Then we'd ask CREP to come back to LCCMR with that report, and let's see what the commission can carve out in the next couple of years to reach their goal. This would get LCCMR back on track with the commission-approved projects, restore confidence in the process, and reinstate those 140 jobs.
Thank you.
A question from Ms. Gibson, Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if you would comment specifically on those deleted projects that I was most alarmed by, being representing one of the University of Minnesota campuses. I noted, I think, at least 10 times that I saw on the list of deleted projects University of Minnesota, including University of Minnesota Duluth, University of Minnesota Crookston, one near and dear to me, the University of Minnesota Bell Museum. I think it was 10. I have to assume that, I mean, in the Bell Museum it's probably education, but many of the others I suspect are research.
Yes.
And the impact of that many research projects being threatened is one that I wonder if I could just ask you specifically about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hausman, yes, there were a lot of University of Minnesota research projects. As I mentioned, these are peer-reviewed projects. They are at the forefront of finding a lot of our environmental and natural resource concerns. As I mentioned, triclosan was one of them. One of them, the analyzing climate data to local planning implementation efforts. This is when all the cities came to the university and asked them to help them how to plan for climate change. They didn't come forward with that project. The cities came to them to ask them to help, for help. They are an incredible resource for us. I'm very proud of the projects that we have funded through this. I can go through some of the other ones if you would like me to mention. I think you've had them in the past. A very interesting one was the freshwater sponges. I didn't know we had freshwater sponges. I just met with National Geographic, and they want to come and photograph our freshwater sponges. That's a resource we didn't know we even had. I didn't know, and I'm a biologist. Obviously the native mussels was very, very popular. The Bell Museum, the interactive water resource programs for planetariums in Minnesota. We're investing a tremendous amount of money in the planetarium and the Bell Museum. This would be an integral part of it. We hope to attract people from around the state, around the country, to this brand new interactive display. The Raptor Center, my gosh, how many times have we been reading about eagles and the situations there are? Where do all these animals go? They go to the Raptor Center at the University of Minnesota. They are top-notch in the nation. They need a boost from the LCCMR. As I said, this is a uniquely qualified fund to meet some of these needs. Workshops and outreach to protect raptors from lead poisoning. We don't allow lead in our homes. Why would we allow it in our fields? The solar cell, high votes from the commission members, 10 out of 15 votes. We know solar cells are one of the highest employers now. They've certainly outdone coal with employees. Extraction of solar thermal energy in Minnesota, another very big popular one. Develop solar-powered robots for weed control in agricultural fields. This is one that came to us late in the game, but we thought it was pretty interesting and was worth a try. They did reduce the amount for that one. So our parks and trails and our state parks and trails and metro parks, these hit everybody statewide. And I think we have a solution. We can ask the LCCMR and CREP to come back and see if we can carve out some budgets for them. This is a very unique fund. I'm very proud to be on it, and I'd really like to see us get back on track with it.
Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I'm a bit confused here. I have a question for the author. Do your numbers balance?
Representative Heitzman.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I would just ask the question, as I have in the past at times, is how much testimony are you going to take on the policy provisions in Ways and Means?
Well, Representative Davids, we do have a policy of taking at least some testimony when people request, and I think Ms. Gibson's the only person who actually signed up and requested to testify on the bill, and so I certainly wanted to honor her request.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think everything that was testified to had fiscal implications, every single one. I, for one, have not proposed any amendments that were pure policy. I think the chair of the tax committee did a few meetings ago, had an amendment that was pure policy, so it's not coming from our side of the aisle. Didn't mention his name, but at any rate, I do want to point out something that I was quite involved in a number of years ago, and that was the Raptor Center. I carried the legislation as part of the Omnibus Higher Education Bill a number of years ago, and it was included. I worked with for the money for the Raptor Center, worked with a Dr. Redding, if I think that his name was. I don't know if he's still there or not.
Yes.
But the point I want to make is the support for getting the first state funding through the University of Minnesota for the Raptor Center was strongly bipartisan. If I recall, I think it probably was unanimous, you know, that we should do that. And there hadn't been much of a history. He was operating on a shoestring at the time. And it's just been highly successful, as was pointed out. The publicity each time, especially a lot of focus on the Eagles, but it's much more than that. So I'm very disappointed to see that particular provision go. Representative Houseman mentioned the Bell Museum. I was quite involved with the planetarium at the time as well. So those are just two areas. But the main point I want to make is that I served a number of years on LCCMR. And I think it has to be understood, perhaps better than it is, that the due diligence of the Commission and how the Commission ranks those projects, researches those projects, the staff, and I'd be very complimentary of the staff. It's a very small staff, but they thoroughly research these issues as well, and we get both staff recommendations, or we did, I'm no longer on it, but the staff recommendations coupled with the testimony input from the scientific community. I mean, it's probably, unless you really want to put in a lot of time, one of the busiest commissions that you can serve on because of the due diligence in that long history. And I think you just heard a few moments ago what that means in that regard. So I hope as this bill moves forward that we're able to reinstate the funding for those projects. I think we have to respect the work of the commission and what they put into it. And when we begin to second-guess that, I think then it sends a very bad message, if you will, to all of the people that are involved, not just the commissioners, but the scientific community and so on. And it appears to me it's the one that takes the hardest hit here is the University of Minnesota. And I've said many times when I was on the commission, if I had a bias, it was to the research of the university. Now, I was trying to be as broad-based as possible, but the university would come forward with just some excellent projects, and I see some of them being literally hurt, destroyed, whatever, as a result of the way the bill is currently crafted. So, Mr. Chairman, I would hope as the bill would come move forward and there's still time on the House floor that it would be reconsidered.
We have Representative Hornstein, Houseman, and Lagenius. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Gibson, I very much appreciated your comments about the process and honoring the process. And I guess I have, based on that, a question for the author. We talked about this a little bit in Environment Committee, but I'm counting among the deleted projects, two that specifically relate to climate change, and then six that relate to solar energy. And, you know, under the category of air quality, climate change, and renewable energy, you have one renewable energy project, which is a biomass boiler at Camp Ripley, but then all of these others were deleted. And again, Ms. Gibson, I think you're calling attention to the climate data and local planning implementation is, I think, especially critical. So my question to the author is, why were six solar projects and two climate-related projects deleted from the LCCMR original recommendation.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative. I'm glad for the opportunity to talk about the bill for a minute. There's been quite a lengthy discussion about projects that have been taken out, projects, of course, that we put back in just earlier, and I'll talk about the process. And for the folks at home and those that are interested, the LCCMR's last stop is the legislature. There's a reason for that. That is a part of the process. And we get to look at all of the provisions that are included and consider many of those things. And, for example, the question specifically that Representative Hornstein is referring to, like, for example, global warming, we have a University of Minnesota project, $300,000 in the first year from the trust fund to the Board of Regents, the University of Minnesota, to determine the effects of increased temperature on the release of mercury and sulfur in Minnesota. And I have a number of other examples of projects like that that are included in the bill. So we could go through and hash out each of these provisions and try to find what was the reasoning behind each one. And I appreciate that, number one, we don't have it necessarily have all afternoon to do that. But secondly, I should mention CREP is also a high priority, and we know that the governor has expressed that he absolutely wants CREP funded. And in this particular bill, $6 million of that funding goes to the staff at SWCDs to do research. So there's a lot more to this bill than we have maybe been discussing in the last few minutes. And it is a priority. It is important that we do make an investment into CREP, and those dollars are federally matched, 3-to-1 is my understanding. That has an impact on jobs as well, and it has an impact on families across the state of Minnesota. They can apply for a CREP in the CREP program and be compensated for that land that is put into a permanent easement. So I think that that has value too.
Representative Hornstein?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick comment and response. I don't think anyone's arguing about why CREP is important. It's just where we're getting the funding from. And so I think it's a very good point, Representative Heitzman. I'm glad you mentioned it, that yes, the legislature is the last stop. But what we're doing is, we created this commission for a reason, and we have citizens on there, citizens, so that citizens can have a say in where this money is allocated, and this is we're making major changes in what the citizens have asked us to do, and I'm just calling attention to the fact that there's a pattern here. Solar and climate change were the among the highest number of projects that were deleted. And I think that's making a statement. That's making a statement from the legislature that we're not necessarily interested in renewable energy and acknowledging the reality and scientific reality of climate change. And so I hope that I appreciate that you've put some stuff back in. And I hope that when this bill makes it to the floor, that some of these projects will also be put back in, because they're absolutely critical, they're timely, and we don't have to play off one set of priorities against another, and I hope that we'll be able to get some of these projects back into the bill, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hausman, then Wagenius and Fabian. Representative Hausman. Representative Wagenius.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would agree that the governor does want CREP funded, and the governor asked for $30 million of bonding dollars for CREP. He did not ask for money to come out of LCCMR. And what I would observe about the governor in relationship to LCCMR is that last time we had a bill come through and come through this committee, there were changes made, and projects were funded that were people's special projects,
and money was taken from LCCR projects, and the governor line item vetoed every one of them, of the ones that had been substituted. So my question for you is, have you talked to the governor about the ones that you are taking away in order to fund the CREP ones?
Representative Weitzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Wagenius. In the last few weeks, I know that the chairs of numerous House committees have reached out to the governor's office and been asking, and in many cases pleading, that he would engage and work with the chairs and let us know where are we at in the process today. And to my knowledge, the governor has not engaged.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, in this case, the governor did engage in the last. I mean, he's told you what he wanted to do. My question is, have other chairs reached out? Have you reached out specifically on this bill to the governor? Have you reached out?
Representative Heisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If anybody would like to give me his phone number, I'd be happy to give him a call.
I've got it.
Very good.
Wow.
Representative Wagenius.
I think we all know where his office is. We office right next door. So one of the things that you mentioned was that the new money that you're putting in for CREP would provide jobs. Actually, it's the money that LCCMR put in, the $6 million, that provides for the jobs for folks to go out and find the lands. So there is not a need for additional money, as I understand it, for CREP for jobs. That's been done in this bill. That was the original bill, the $6 million. So the add-on that you made is just for land purchases, I understand. So I just, folks out there need to understand that that is a normal thing that we do with bonding dollars, and that's what the governor asked for. But the other thing, and I didn't know that Ms. Gibson was going to make a suggestion to you that I thought was a pretty good one, that if we go forward with LCCMR the way it is, people can come back and ask for LCCMR dollars in the next go around for the actual lands work. So that seems like a wise idea, so folks can come together, that we can actually work together rather than work separately. So I thought that was an excellent idea, and I hope that that becomes part of the thinking of this committee as we go forward.
I will say, you know, Representative Heisman, I assume that I know the governor's got intergovernmental relations people that certainly can talk to you. Have they reached out and talked to you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the question. Nobody has reached out to me from the governor's office.
All right. Is there someone from the governor's office here that would like to say something to Representative Heitzman? I don't see any response. Well, anyway, okay. Ms. Gibson, I think we're done with questions for you. Thank you also for your service on this and your service to the state.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Representative Heitzman? Representative Heitzman, would you like to make some closing comments?
I'll be very brief. I appreciate the opportunity to bring the amendments and the LCCMR bill to the Ways and Means Committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
So no further discussion. The chair will renew his motion that House File 1265, as amended, be referred to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. House File 1265, as amended, is referred to the General Register. Members, I don't have any other business for the day. There may well be another meeting coming up later this week. We will keep you posted as to when it might be.
And with that, members, we are adjourned.